Good afternoon, everybody. Sorry for the technical difficulties. We're starting a little bit late, but here we are. Let's get going. What a good-looking crowd. A lot of people here. This is fantastic. I always start out thanking everybody for the treat table. Thank you for bringing treats. Thank you for eating treats. Bring about a little bit more than you eat. That's a good rule of thumb, I think. And remember that somehow, like the loaves and fishes, the treat table replenishes itself about halfway through class often. So if you think you've finished it, you haven't, get up and go find something. So I want to introduce a visitor we have this morning to class. Would you stand up and tell us your name again and tell us where you're from and why you're bothering to come here? Great. Well, welcome. You put up with all the nonsense in California for the bug-free, humidity-free, perfect weather that we have, right? Well, enjoy yourself. Welcome. Okay, so we've got Dr. Ross with us this morning. Yes, say hi. Say. And for two more weeks after that. And we're going to have Robert Cavolo on April 26th, and I think he's going to teach on Soren Kierkegaard. How many of you guys know who Soren Kierkegaard was? Danish theologian. So you better come and learn some more, because he's a really good teacher. Let's see. Oh, I got to tell you something about myself, something you didn't know. I come from a family of failed magicians. I have two half-sisters. Is that good enough, you? Yeah, okay. I have to sacrifice myself to tell dumb jokes because Hugh wants me up here to say something that's funny. Okay, I did. All right, so I think that's everything on my list. Oh, RTB is 40 years old this year, right, Hugh? Are we going to have a big celebration RTB party, or what's going on? I guess I did. Are we going to do? We should do something in the class for that. Yeah. Okay. All right. Well, let's say a prayer, and we'll get to Dr. Ross. Somebody's. Oh. Thank you. Heavenly Father, thank you as always for this class. We're so grateful that we can worship you with our mind as well as our heart and our emotions. Thank you for Dr. Ross and his faithfulness and loyalty to this class and to you, Lord. Thank you for his teaching. He's awakened the whole world of apologetics to us, Lord. We're eternally grateful. Thank you for this weather. Thank you for these beautiful days. We ask your blessing on this, on all of us as we listen to Dr. Ross. Bless him as he teaches us and bless each of us as we go our way this afternoon. Thank you, Lord. In Jesus' very precious name, amen. Please welcome Dr. Hugh Ross.
Well, thank you. And Ross was commenting on the weather here. Whenever my Canadian relatives would come down and visit us, they would say, how do you ever get used to 365 perfect days a year? And it's like, well, you do get to tolerate it, so. Well, welcome to the class, and it's always good to have new people in the class and new people to participate with us online. And again, I'm going to teach for about 30 minutes, then we're going to have Q&A. We're going to alternate between people online and people that are here in person, and you can ask any question you want. It doesn't have to be on the theme what we're talking about right now. But I'm wondering if we can get the slides up. Are we having a problem with the slides? Do you want me to start it up again? Okay, give the tech people a minute. The series we're going through is on the theology and science of the first four chapters of the Bible, Genesis 1 through 4. And we're now into Genesis chapter 2, and it looks like we're going to get the slides up. Let's see. There we go. Fantastic. Okay. Well, just to do a quick review, what we're going to be seeing in Genesis chapter 2, last week we looked at the first proof in Genesis chapter 2 that the creation days are consecutive long periods of time. And we're going to look at a second proof in today's class. But just to quickly review, what you notice is in the first four verses of Genesis chapter 2 that the phrase, there was evening and there was morning, is missing. It's not there. And the reason it's missing, we're still in God's seventh day. We know that because of what we see in Psalm 95, John 5, and Hebrews 4. What we see in Psalm 95 is this passage, they have not known my ways, so I declared on oath in my anger, they shall not enter my rest, referring to the rebellious Jews, his rest being the seventh day. And when Jesus was confronted by the hypocritical religious leaders, he said to them, my Father is always at work to this very day, and I too am working, making the point that the principle of the Sabbath is we work for 6 days, and on the seventh day, we cease from our normal work to focus on the most important issues of life, and that is a work. It's a different kind of work. And we see in Hebrews chapter 4, on the seventh day, God rested from all his work of creating. It still remains that some of us, will enter that rest. So the seventh day is ongoing. And if you want a thorough description of this, read all of Hebrews 4, verses 1 through 11. And I told the story last week of how when I read this at age 17, it answered for me, excuse me, an enigma that had bothered me since I was 10 and a half. And that's the fact that when you look at evolution or biology, we notice that we see in the fossil record new phyla, new classes, new orders and families appearing frequently throughout the record of time before humans, but none of that happens after humans. For 6 days, God creates. On the seventh day, he stops creating. And how that explains why you see a difference when you survey men and women of research science in the different scientific disciplines. How when you survey research mathematicians, over 80% believe in God and an afterlife. When you survey physical chemists, it's about 65% that believe in God and an afterlife. Physicists and astronomers and geologists, it's about half. But when you get into the life sciences, and especially when you get into the social sciences, the percentage plummets. In the life sciences, it's around 25%. When you get into the social sciences, it's typically below 1%. And the point there is, when you're in the life sciences, and especially the social sciences, you're doing all your research on God's seventh day. And therefore, when you talk to some of the social sciences, they'll say, well, in my research, I see no evidence for God's supernatural interventions. Well, of course, they're doing the research on the wrong day. If you're looking at it in the human era, this is when God is at rest. Now, of course, not all life sciences are focusing their research on the human era, which is why you get a significantly higher percentage of people in the life sciences than you do in the social sciences. And this is where we ended up last week. If God supernaturally intervenes so much in preparing Earth and its life for humans, this is what you see in Genesis chapter 1, then how much more must he care and supernaturally intervene in the life of every human being? So, for example, there's two Old Testament texts that tell us that God knows the name of every star. Well, these stars are just huge balls of hydrogen and helium gas. And it's like, hey, if God knows the names of all these big balls of hydrogen and helium gas, do you think he knows your name, since you're much more complex than just a big ball of hydrogen and helium gas? And that God can literally name 5 trillion stars after every human being. So if he knows the names of all the stars, I think he knows your name as well. And how God designed every aspect of the universe, Earth and Earth's past and present life for humanity's benefit and to equip humans to fulfill their destiny. In my book, Designed at the Core, I make the point that the universe and all of its subcomponents are designed not only to make possible the existence of human beings on a planet to make possible billions of humans to live in one planet where those billions can be redeemed from their sin and evil. So that's a quick review of what we see in Genesis 1, what we covered last week. What I want to do today is focus on the main theme of Genesis 2, the fact that God has given us a mission. He basically takes Adam and says, this is the mission I have assigned to you. This is what you're responsible to do. And this is a mission that you need to bestow upon all of your progeny. So it's a mission for all of us. And this answers a question of why you have two side-by-side creation texts in the Bible. Genesis 1 has a physical focus. Genesis 2 has a spiritual focus. What we see in Genesis 1 is God creates three distinct kinds of life, physical life, soulish life, and last of all, spiritual life. And in Genesis 2 has a spiritual focus where God trains Adam how to manage the three different kinds of life that he's created. Basically, Genesis 1 ends with a charge to humanity. I'm putting you in control of the planet and all of its resources. You're to manage it for your benefit and the benefit of all life. But if you read what skeptics say about Genesis 2, they will claim that Genesis 2 contradicts Genesis 1, but it's because they think that Genesis 1 is giving us a chronology and Genesis 2 is repeating that chronology. It is true that you're getting a chronological story in Genesis 1 and a chronological story in Genesis 2, but it's a completely different chronology. So for example, in Genesis chapter 1, the physical events are chronologically sequenced, but not the relational events. As you look at the end of Genesis chapter 1, you'll notice the chronological clues are missing when God's assigning authority and responsibility to human beings. In Genesis 2, it's the exact reverse. The physical events are not sequenced, but the spiritual events are. And so we see God's assignment of responsibility and authority being chronologically sequenced, but the physical events are not. And you notice in Genesis 1, you're getting a one-sentence statement about humanity's authority and responsibility. In Genesis 2, you're getting a whole chapter. And also, you look at Genesis 2, you're getting a single-sentence description of the physical creation. The rest of the text is about the spiritual creation. So, for example, we see in Genesis chapter 2, it tells us in verse 5 that in Eden, before God planted the garden, there was no shrubs, plants, rain, or humans. Now, this is where skeptics will jump into the text and say, oh, the text here is saying God creates shrubs first, plants second, rain third, and humans last of all. And they say that contradicts Genesis chapter 1. What they're not realizing is there's no chronological clues about these four items. It's simply God picking four highlights from Genesis chapter 1 and not putting them into any intended chronological order. It's basically saying, hey, if you want the details, they're in Genesis chapter 1. But these are the highlights that are most significant for Adam and Eve doing what God intends them to do in the Garden of Eden. So it's a mistake to read Genesis 2-5 as a chronological series. And especially when you look at it in the original Hebrew, you can see the chronological clues. So like in Genesis chapter 1, you've got numbered days. This is telling us that physical events are in a particular sequence. You have God stopping at the end of each day saying, and it was so, being repeated throughout. That's a clue that we're to interpret this chronologically. And then you got the statement, it was good. It was good being repeated. So you have multiple clues in Genesis 1 telling us that the physical events are to be understood as a chronology. That's missing when you come to the physical events in Genesis 2, but what's present are the chronological clues for God assigning responsibility and authority. So that deals with one skeptical challenge of the text. A second skeptical challenge is people look at Genesis 2 and imply that there was no rain falling. Okay, did it rain? Well, it tells us it doesn't use the Hebrew word for rain, namely ed. Instead, it uses the Hebrew word matar. And so it talks about how a mist or a fog came over the Garden of Eden. Uses the word matar, not the word rain. But this is what led people to conclude. There was no rain until Noah's flood. There was no rainbows until Noah's flood. Well, I mean, often here in California, we'll get days where, in fact, this morning, if you got up really early, there was a fog, okay? Now, I grew up in coastal British Columbia. We get really thick fogs there. And you know what a thick fog is? It's little tiny drops of liquid water in the atmosphere close to the ground. And when the sun begins to burn through the fog, what do you get? You get a rainbow. You don't need big drops of rain to get a rainbow. Any size drop of rain will give you a rainbow. So, there were rainbows in the Garden of Eden. There were rainbows on creation day two when God set up the water cycle. So, the idea that there was no rain until Noah's flood is biblically incorrect. It just means big drops of water falling in the sky. Matar means tiny drops of liquid water in the sky. In fact, I often joke that when I grew up in coastal British Columbia, we referred to our rainstorms as a mist if the raindrops were smaller than 3/16 of an inch in diameter. If they're bigger than that, we call it a rain. And so if you're living, say, in the Persian Gulf area, again, you typically are getting tiny drops of water, not big drops of water. Okay, let me deal with another challenge. This is not coming from atheist skeptics. It's coming from Christian believers who look at Adam and Eve and say, isn't that evidence that God creates with the appearance of age? And this is basically the young earth creationist camp who say, well, if God created Adam and Eve with the appearance of age, couldn't he create galaxies and stars with the appearance of age? But I would argue, based on Hebrews chapter 6, God never creates anything with the appearance of age, because it tells us in Hebrews 6, it's impossible for God to lie or deceive. Why would he create something with a false appearance of age? But here's the problem with Adam and Eve. If you look at their body size, you know, whether they're 5 feet tall or 6 feet tall, the problem is you're looking at their height and using that as an indicator of age. But here's the fallacy. Neither Adam nor Eve came from the womb of a woman. Therefore, their body size when God created them would be no indicator of age. God, in creating Adam from the dust of the earth, could make him as big as he wants instantly. So his body size would not be an indicator of age. And you say, well, why did God make Adam full-sized right away? It's the problem of the chicken or the egg. If we're talking about an advanced animal, the chickens come first, because the little chick coming out of the egg can't take care of itself. Likewise, a human newborn coming out of the womb of a woman can't take care of itself. It needs an adult to take care of itself. And so Adam and Eve are examples. The chicken comes first. So if anybody ever asks you what comes first, the chickens or the eggs, well, if it's a microbe, the eggs can come first. But if it's a big animal, the chickens do indeed come first. But I think God had a reason for creating Adam and Eve full size rather than having them, say, the size of a toddler. When a baby comes out of its mother's womb, its brain size is about one-third that of a full-grown adult, which means it's going to take that baby a little longer to become completely language fluent. And as you look at Genesis chapter 2, you notice we have God speaking to Adam relatively quickly after he is created. Well, if he has a full-sized brain, he's going to acquire language far more rapidly than a baby will. I mean, I notice with my sons, they were able to speak and complete paragraphs by the time they're 18 months of age, mainly because I'm married to a woman that's quite verbal, and because she's very verbal, they were able to pick up language capability quite quickly. So Adam and Eve learned and spoke faster because God created them with full-sized brains. But the whole point is Adam and Eve are not examples of God creating with the appearance of age, because they're unique amongst humans. They did not come from the womb of a woman. Well, where is the Garden of Eden? You don't get a very good clue from verse 8. It says the Garden of Eden is in the east. Well, where is the east? From our perspective, New York is the east, right? And if you're living, say, in Europe, then Cairo would be the east. But we do get a clue about Eden's location, because it tells us explicitly in the text, it's a location where four rivers come close together. And it names the rivers, the Tigris and the Euphrates, the Pishon and the Gihon. And it tells us that the Tigris and Euphrates come from the region of Asher. That would be Mesopotamia. So it tells us in the text that they flow through Mesopotamia. It tells us that the Pishon flows out of the mountains of Havilah, where there is gold, and Gihon flows out of the mountains of Cush. Well, you can look at biblical texts from the rest of the Old Testament, where we do a search for Havilah and Cush, and these are locations you'll find. Asher, indeed, is Mesopotamia. That's easy to identify. Havilah are the mountains in central western Arabia. And during the last ice age, those mountains had big glaciers and snowfields upon them. And likewise, there's mountains in southwestern Arabia. And again, during the previous ice age, there was snow and glaciers on top of those mountains. And so whereas today, only the Tigris and Euphrates are flowing, because they're flowing from the glaciers and snowfields in the mountains of Ararat, and so those rivers are flowing today. The Gihon and the Pishon are now dry riverbeds. There's no longer any ice and snow on the mountains of Havilah. There's no ice and snow on the mountains of Cush, and so both rivers today are dry riverbeds. But Genesis 2 tells us that all four rivers were flowing. So right away that tells us the Garden of Eden event must be an ice age event, because only during an ice age would all four rivers be flowing. Now, what I'm showing you here is a satellite image of Arabia. You can go on the NASA website and you can see a much higher resolution image, and you can actually detect the dry riverbeds of the Gihon and the Pishon rivers. It tells us in Genesis 2 that the Pishon winds its way through the mountains of Havilah, and also comes out of the mountains of Cush. And so this is the traditional location of the Garden of Eden. I argue that that is incorrect, because the four rivers don't come close together in that location. Actually, what we notice is that the Garden of Eden is in this location. This is the one location where the four rivers come close together. And so that means, again, that the Garden of Eden event must be an ice age event, because only during an ice age event would you have most of the Persian Gulf as dry land. In fact, there are times during the previous ice age when 95% of the Persian Gulf was dry land. And what I show here in this particular image, kind of a blow up of the Persian Gulf, the four arrows show you the entry points of the Tigris and the Euphrates. The Tigris is the topmost one. One just below that is where the Euphrates comes into the Persian Gulf. The Pishon would be the bottom left arrow, and then the Gihon would be the entry point of the bottom right is the entry point of the Gihon River. And those four do indeed come together in the location you see there, the Garden of Eden. So that location today is a little more than 200 feet below sea level, but during the last ice age, it would be above sea level. Now, this also answers the question. It tells us in Genesis chapter 2 that Adam and Eve were wandering around the Garden of Eden without clothes, and apparently were quite comfortable wandering around in the Garden of Eden. You say, well, during an ice age, aren't the global mean temperatures much lower? Indeed, they are. Quite a bit lower, as much as 10 degrees centigrade lower, 18 degrees Fahrenheit lower than they are today. But what we do know is the hottest place on Earth is the Persian Gulf. And that was true also during the last ice age. And so today, if you were in that location, you wouldn't be wandering around without clothes on. You'd be miserably hot. You'd be dying of heat stroke. And so you can live there in that region, but you better have the air conditioner on because it's really the hottest place on Earth. But during the last ice age, it would have been comfortable for humans to wander around without clothes on because during the ice age, the global mean temperature is so much lower than it is today. But that kind of gives you a rationale for why God planted this garden in this location and then created Adam and Eve and had them wandering around there without clothing. Okay, now, I mentioned at the beginning that what we see in Genesis chapter 2 is a second biblical proof that the creation days in Genesis chapter 1 are long periods of time. They're not 24 hours. The second proof comes from God introducing Adam to the three different kinds of life. And the first thing God does is that he creates Adam, not in the garden, he's created outside the garden. If you're ever wondering why God held Adam to greater account than Eve, Eve only witnessed the conditions of Eden. Adam saw both what life was like outside of Eden and life was like inside of Eden. So he noticed the contrast. Outside of Eden, you got thorns and thistles and you got wild growth going on out there. Inside the garden, you have a garden planted by God, tended by God. And so it's like having a backyard like I have in San Dimas compared to what you see at Huntington Gardens. I can tell you there's a significant difference. And it's much more pleasant to be walking around Huntington Gardens than the backyard that I have. You know, people always ask me, well, how do you find time to write all these books? I don't golf, I don't fish, and I do my best to avoid gardening. Okay. But Adam was created outside the garden. Then God put him in the garden. And what's the first thing the text tells us when Adam is put in the Garden of Eden? He has the opportunity to watch trees in the Garden of Eden grow. So right away, he's there long enough to see trees growing. And having seen the trees grow, God says, you know, these trees are getting a little bit out of control. You need to tend the garden. And so God has Adam tending the Garden of Eden. Now, this is a garden planted by God. So you can imagine tending a garden planted by God, this is really going to be enjoyable gardening. It's not like trying to take care of my backyard. This is really an incredible garden, very beautiful. And so Adam be highly motivated to keep it in the condition that God gave it to him. And that's something God told him to do. And so I believe that he received a lot of pleasure and a lot of satisfaction from tending the Garden of Eden. Just maintaining the beauty of the garden must have given him great pleasure. But this is God introducing Adam to the physical creation. And then God was saying, you know, there's more to the garden than just the physical creation. And this is where God has him introduced to the soulish creation. And so it tells us in the text that he is to examine all the animals in the garden and give them appropriate names. Now, what a lot of people miss, he's not really examining the cockroaches. He's not examining the houseflies. He's not examining the creatures that are there, the salamanders. He's focusing on the soulish animals, the nephesh animals, the animals that God designed to relate to as human beings. This Hebrew word nephesh refers to any animal that we can tame to relate to us or to do our bidding. It would include all the birds and mammals. Every bird and mammal species is capable of being tamed by us human beings. These are animals that desire to relate to us, form a relationship with us. There are a few reptilian species that are in that category where they can form an emotional bond with human beings and be tamed by human beings, but they're really only a few. And what we notice when you look at the book of Job, the oldest book in the Bible, it tells us that God designed these soulish animals, each in a different way, to relate to you in a distinct way. So you probably observed this. Your cat relates to you in a different way than your dog does. your parrot will relate to you in a different way than the cat or the dog does. God has designed each of these animals to relate to us humans in a distinct way. And this is what the text means when God told Adam, I want you to carefully examine all these nephesh animals and give them an appropriate name. And so I believe that Adam was basically naming all these creatures, giving him a distinct name for how God designed them to relate to him as a human being, how they were designed to serve and please him in different distinct manners. And yeah, some predominantly serve, like the farm animals. Other animals, like the carnivores, predominantly please us in the relationships with us. So we did this. And the whole point here is, it takes time for Adam to watch the trees grow. It takes time for Adam to realize there's got to be more to life than gardening. And then there takes time for Adam to realize all of these creatures are designed to relate to me in a distinct way, but there's not a single one of them that can relate to me in a way that really is fulfilling. And so we have Adam receiving pleasure, receiving service, and much fulfillment from each of these nephesh. Nevertheless, he came to a point where he realized something was missing. God looked down on him and realized this guy is lonely. Now, you're probably aware there's a difference between men and women. It takes men a little longer to feel lonely than women do. But I would argue this is one proof that these creation days can't be 24-hour periods, because any of you tried to relate to a man, it takes them much longer than 24 hours to recognize that he is lonely or that he is alone. It can't happen at the end, a few minutes at the end of a 24-hour day. So God observes that he's alone. And then what does God do? He puts Adam to sleep, gives him some kind of anesthesia, and then under sleep, he takes something from his side. Now, a lot of the older English translations will say that God removed a rib from Adam's side, but what the original Hebrew word tells us, he removed some tissue from Adam's side. Doesn't tell us how much tissue he removed. And therefore, I think an appropriate translation there is that God took a biopsy from Adam's side. So it could be a single cell, it could be a bunch of cells, it could be even a part of Adam's rib, but something was taken from his side. So either a very tiny or a small biopsy, and God used that in his construction project of putting the body of Eve together. And so he creates Eve, and then Adam gets to wake up from his anesthesia, and then when he sees, he realizes, of all creatures, only Eve could fulfill Adam physically, soulishly, and spiritually. And to me, the most significant here is that when Adam sees Eve, the word you see coming out of his mouth in the original Hebrew is the word hapa'am. It's used about 20 times in the Old Testament. Almost always it's translated at long last. So again, the several Hebrew scholars, most notably Gleason Archer, have argued, based on Genesis 2 alone, the creation days of Genesis 1 must be long periods of time, because look how much time transpires between God creating Adam and God creating Eve. When I talked to Gleason when he was alive, I said, well, how much time do you think transpired between God creating Adam and God creating Eve? He says, I believe it's at least a year. It has to be at least several months, because it takes a few months to watch trees grow. It takes a few months to realize there's got to be more to life than gardening. It takes quite a while to name all these soulish animals and figure out what's an appropriate name to give to them. And then you got the phrase, at long last, coming out of Adam's mouth. Now, a lot of people debate about, you know, how did God create Adam and Eve? Well, these are species of life that's physical, soulish, and spiritual. So I'd argue, it tells us with respect to Adam, he made his body from the dust of the earth. He took a biopsy from Adam's side, which means he may have been re-engineering a DNA sample from Adam. I mean, you know, men and women have very similar DNA. God could take the DNA out of Adam, re-engineer that DNA, and now he's got the DNA of a woman. And he could also create from an act transcendent to space and time. And again, you see this explicitly in the text. It says, after God had created the body of Adam, he breathed into him the breath of life. Basically saying, now I got this physical body, and with the physical body, God can step in and breathe the spirit into this physical body. But the whole point here, what you see in Genesis 1, only one species of life here on earth is body, soul, and spirit, namely anatomically modern humans. All other life forms are either purely physical or just physical and soulish. Humans alone are body, soul, and spirit. And what's interesting in Genesis chapter 2 is it uses the Hebrew word yatsar to talk about God creating Adam and Eve. What you see in Genesis chapter 1, it uses two words, the word bara to create, the word asa to manufacture. Interesting about the Hebrew word yatsar, it combines both the manufacture and the creation into one verb. And again, that's making the point. Some of the aspects of the creation of Adam and Eve are physical, some are soulish, as some are spiritual. Well, I'm through my 30 minutes. Let me give you a preview of what we're going to talk about next week. We're going to finish Genesis chapter 2 and jump into chapter 3. But I think the most significant thing that's often missed about Genesis chapter 2 is that, Adam refers to Eve not as his helpmeet, but as his Ezer. So next week, we're actually going to get into what does this word Ezer mean. And it basically has everything to do with the mission that God is assigning to Adam and Eve. So I would argue, if you ever see an English translation that says help me, that's not correct. Ezer has a much deeper meaning. So we're going to get into that and why that was crucial for the events we're going to see in Genesis chapter 3. Basically, God is forewarning Adam and Eve that they're being created to go into battle. And they say, what battle? And they said, you're soon going to find out. That's Genesis chapter 3. The battle begins in Genesis chapter 3. But God basically is saying to Adam, this creature I made for you is an Ezer. And he says, what do I need an Ezer for? He says, you're going to find out very quickly why you need this Ezer. So that's next week. Okay, let's begin with a question from our online audience.
Before we get started with questions, Hugh, I want to say because we started late, we're going to run a little later than usual, if it's okay with you.
That's fine.
We're going to go to 1:40 our time, so that's 40 minutes from now if you're in a different time zone. And just like always, we'll take turns alternating between online questions and live in the audience questions. So if you're here in the audience, there's no line yet. There's one person in line. Of course, Doug's here. So he's in line. Yes. Okay. So there's
so
nobody
you heard
behind
that.
Doug.
If you want to ask a question, if you're here in person, please get behind the microphone because we record everything here and want people downloading the recording to be able to hear your question.
That's
let's take an online question.
So let's start with a question from JGGB9. Dr. Ross, can you comment on the zipper-like metal formation found inside ancient rock near St. Petersburg? I don't know what that's referring to. Do you?
I don't know what that's referring to either. A zippered rock?
Zipper-like metal formation.
Zipper-like metal formation. So it sounds like it's some kind of crystal that can zipper together.
Well,
but
let's
you know
ask JGB9 to give us a little more detail, and I'll re-ask the question.
Yeah. I mean, okay. If he can give me the paper where this is right, then I'll be happy to comment it, but I'm not going to comment on something I know nothing about.
Okay, I'll ask another one. From Tom Longo, one of our most reliable, loyal friends online. He's in Tennessee. He says, Dr. Ross, what is the significance or the meaning of Revelation 10:9 through 10:11, which has to do with the little scroll?
Yeah. Well, if you were here in the class 40 years ago, we went through the book of Revelation. It took us 7 years and 9 months to get through that book. which is why people refer to that 7 years and 9 months as the Great Tribulation. It talks about this little scroll. And kind of the principle we use in going through the book of Revelation is to recognize it's using symbols. It's using symbols in order to be able to condense the vast amount of prophetic literature you see in the Old Testament. And incidentally, that's why it took us 7 years and 9 months. I told the leaders of this church, if you want me to teach in the book of Revelation, we're going to have to cover over one-third of the Old Testament at the same time, because that's where all these symbols are defined. And so it talks about this little scroll. And so the scrolls come up all the time. There's a scroll where it actually lists all the names of the people that are going to be redeemed by God. So you've given your life to Jesus Christ, your name gets written in that scroll, which means that you pass from this life to the next life, and you're going to be able to enjoy eternity with God and his followers. And you say, well, what about people who are not in that book? Well, they're all the ones that want nothing to do with God or his followers. And that's basically what God says. You've got a choice in these 80 or 90 years to spend here on earth. Who do you want to spend eternity with? So I would argue God never sends people to hell. People choose hell. They want nothing to do with God and his followers. He says, I got a special place for you. I've actually argued in Beyond the Cosmos, God actually optimizes conditions in the lake of fire, in hell, based on the decision that the individuals there have made. But it also talks about a scroll that's going to be revealed, that's going to basically tell us things we don't know yet. So when you're reading the book of Revelation, there's more than one scroll. And what you're seeing there in Revelation 10 is that there's going to be a scroll that's going to reveal things to humanity. And apparently even the angels themselves are going to be struck by what is revealed in that scroll. And so there is a scroll that's been hidden up until that time. It will be revealed, and it's going to have a stunning effect. If you want more insight on what's going on there, we do have the entire Revelation course that I taught 40 years ago on a set of MP3s, and you can download them for free at paradoxes.org. And if I can recall, I think we spent two whole Sundays going over that scroll. So I'll leave it at that. If you want the details, you can find it on that set of MP3s. Okay, Doug, what's your question?
I'm amazed how people can just ask you anything from the Bible and you seem to know a lot about it. I guess that's what years of study does. I was listening to what you said. I'm thinking possibly, it's just possible that in the case of Adam and Eve, they were transformed from a hominid into a soulish, God created the image. Although the Bible does say they were created from the dust of the earth, right? But if he could do what he did with Eve, he could, you know, like transform a hominid where, you know, you don't have to just, I don't know, it's just a possibility. But my my question is, if you're talking to a person who believes in evolution, I have an interesting question. I was wondering how they were, if you had an experience, how they react to such questions. For example, if the blood vessels evolved before there was blood, why did they evolve if there was no such thing as blood? And if blood evolved before the heart evolved, what was it that kept it circulating around the body? The only reasonable answer is to these questions is that God made the human body, but I'm wondering what they say. This is from Ray Comfort, by the way. He's a young earth creationist, but he has some great evangelical questions and things.
Okay, good Thank question, you. Doug. Where you can find a full treatment on that is that we at Reasons to Believe did a full book debate with the scientists and theologians at BioLogos. That's an organization founded by Francis Collins. And Francis Collins came to me years ago and said, you know, this subject of science and creation and the Bible is highly controversial. Christians really tend to get quite vicious towards one another when they quote dialogue on this topic. He said, how about if our two organizations debate this topic, but where we treat one another the way the Bible tells us we should treat one another, with respect, gentleness, and charity. So I appreciated that Francis Collins came to me with that proposal, and we did indeed write a full-length book, chapter by chapter, where they laid out their position, we laid out our position. Each of us began by saying where we agree with one another, and then we're very forthright with where we disagreed. And when we launched that book project, I thought, well, we're going to be disagreeing on the science much more than we're disagreeing the Bible. When we were done with the book, we realized it was the opposite. We agreed much more on the science, but we greatly disagreed on how we interpreted the Bible. On the other hand, the goal of Francis Collins and myself was achieved. The debate was charitable all the way through. But most of the debate was focused on the question that Doug brought up. Are humans the product of special creation, or are we the product of some kind of natural evolution through common descent from an ancestor that preceded us? So the people of Biologos held the view that modern humans and Neanderthals evolved from a common ancestor, and that all of us evolved from a common ancestor with the chimpanzees, whereas we took the position that all the bipedal primates were special creation acts by God, and that we are all indeed descended from Adam and Eve. Now, I also discovered that the people at Biologos held different views on the origin of Adam and Eve. Some of them believed that God took a male and a female from a group of hominids and breathed supernaturally into them the breath of life and made a spiritual being. Others took the position, there was a large population of these hominids and that they all had some spiritual capability, but God took two from there. And some even denied the fact that it was two, saying it can't be two, it has to be thousands. So it was quite a broad spectrum of positions that are represented there at Biologos, and it's fully represented in the Two Views book that we did with them. If you want to see that Two Views book, you can go to reasons.org and go under the store, you'll find the book that is there. I think what helped the book too, we felt, hey, in order to maintain the charity, let's involve Southern Baptist theologians basically to pose questions, because the publisher was concerned that we were going to get at such a high scientific level that we're going to not be communicating to lay people. So they required that we have a Southern Baptist theologian moderate the dialogue, and they basically took the position of asking us questions. Please answer this question, but answer it in a way that a lay reader can understand what you're saying. And they did a good job of doing that. But what I've put in my latest book on this subject, Rescuing Inerrancy, and this is brand new. This was not, we didn't have this data at the time we were doing the Two Views book. There's now a consensus amongst physical anthropologists that all of these bipedal primate species that preceded anatomically modern humans had low population levels. So for example, research now tells us that the maximum population ever achieved by the Neanderthals was 15,000 individuals, and much more likely less than 8,000 individuals. Well, with that few individuals, you're not going to have any evolution going on. And that explains why Neanderthal remains that are nearly 400,000 years old look the same as remains that are 45,000 years old. With that few individuals, there's not going to be any evolutionary change occurring. And you get the same conclusions with respect to Homo erectus, the Australopithecines, the Denisovans. They all had really low population levels. So how did they discover that? Well, particularly with the Denisovans and the Neanderthals, they noticed that their DNA was extremely inbred, and that inbreeding can only be explained if their population levels were low, and they were spread over a large, because that's the other thing we see. Not only did they have low populations, they were inhabiting a very large region of the Earth's surface, which means that your typical Neanderthal didn't know many other Neanderthals. The ones that lived thousands of miles away, they wouldn't have any contact with. And that would explain the extreme inbreeding signal that we see in the DNA samples. Okay, next question.
Craig McMahon has a good question online. He says, in Genesis 11, the age at which each father has a son is given precisely, suggesting a short time span between Noah and Abraham. How does one interpret this so as to decouple the sum of those years to provide a longer time span?
Yeah, really good question. And this really throws people who are reading the English translations of Genesis 5 and 11 genealogies. Because what you see in most English translations, when X had a child, at so many different years, and people get the implication the text is talking about the direct offspring of that particular individual. But three words help. Okay, the word for father in biblical Hebrew, Ab, also means grandfather, great-grandfather, great-great-grandfather. Likewise, the word for son, Ben, means grandson, great-grandson, great-great-grandson, etc. So that alone allows, when it says X gave birth to Y, it could be X giving birth to Y, but X giving rise to a line that culminates or ends with Y. And it's based on the verb used there in the text, the verb yalad. And there are two individuals that are part of our volunteer scholar team, Hugh Henry and Dan Dyke. And they've written several articles you'll find at reasons.org. Does the verb yalad mean that there are no gaps in the genealogies? And I'll tell you their bottom line. They're saying it actually demonstrates there must be gaps in the Genesis 5 and 11 genealogies. Therefore, Genesis 5 and 11 should not be interpreted as calendars or clocks. And we know they can't be, because if you start from Adam and go forward to Noah, you get a different date for when Noah lived than if you start from Moses and go back to Noah. The two dates differ by 110 years if you assume there's no gaps in the genealogies. So based on that alone. But the whole point is, Hebrew has a much smaller vocabulary than English, and therefore these nouns and verbs have much broader definitions. But yeah, go to the papers written by Hugh Henry and Dan Dyke at reasons.org. You'll get a full explanation. And incidentally, this is not debated amongst theologians who are fluent in biblical Hebrew. They all acknowledge, including even the young earth creationists among them, that Genesis 5 and Genesis 11 are not clocks, they're not calendars. There are gaps in the genealogies. The big debate is, how many gaps are there in the genealogies? And incidentally, you got 11 names between Adam and Noah. In Luke, you got 10 names in Genesis chapter 5. So there again, that tells us there has to be some missing generations. Okay, next question.
Good afternoon. Was Adam created with a penis from the beginning?
Was Adam created without what?
Penis? Penis?
Without pain?
Penis.
Oh, without a penis.
Or was his body modified when Eve was created?
Yeah. Well, again, that's like the question, did God create Adam with a belly button? I mean, the text doesn't tell us. But yes, God intended that Adam and Eve would immediately start producing children, because what do we see in Genesis chapter 1? God saying, multiply and fill the earth. So God intended that both Adam and Eve would be sexual and capable of producing a large number of children. So I would argue God did indeed create Adam with a penis. He created Eve with a vagina. His intent was they would be able to multiply and fill the earth. In fact, I have a chapter in my book, Navigating Genesis, making the point that Adam could have fulfilled that command while he was still alive. If it wasn't for the sin of murder, there would have been 17 billion people on the face of the earth long before Adam and Eve had finished out their life. That obviously didn't happen because of what we see in Genesis chapter 4. The vast majority of humans living before the flood had their lives terminated by being murdered by their fellow man. And again, what you see after the flood, God tells Noah, multiply and fill the earth. Only this time the command is much more direct and basically tells him, you've got to restrain this murder. I really do want you to multiply and fill the earth. And again, that's an indication. Humanity had not filled the earth at the time of Noah. So the flood of wiping out all of humanity doesn't have to be global because humanity at that time had not yet spread across all the land masses of the earth. Okay.
Here's somebody with a great online handle, Hugh. They call themselves Beach Bum Zero.
Okay.
And Beach Bum Zero says, Dr. Ross, how would you answer an objection saying that Adam and Eve should not be held responsible for eating of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil because before they ate, they didn't know right from wrong?
Okay. Yeah. God said there's this tree, the knowledge of good and evil, and he forbade them from eating of that tree. I believe God's intent was that he would instruct Adam and Eve about good and evil rather than having them personally experience the difference between good and evil. That's what happened when they ate of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. They now personally experience the difference. God's intent all along was he would instruct them on the difference so they wouldn't have to personally experience it. I think all of us have been parents. I can empathize with that. We much rather our children would listen to our instructions about good and evil rather than going out and personally experiencing for themselves the difference for good and evil because we know the damage that will bring into their life. Likewise, God understood the damage that would come if they ate from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. Now, what we're going to do when we get into chapter 3 is answer the question, well, why did God put that tree there in the first place? Couldn't he just not have the tree there and basically instruct them on the difference for good and evil? We're also going to answer the question, you know, God's all-powerful. He could have kept Satan out of the garden. Why did he let him in the garden? I want you to think about those questions because those are the questions we're going to address when we get into Genesis chapter 3. In fact, when I get into Genesis chapter 3, I'm not going to do a lot of teaching. I'm going to be asking a lot of questions. Questions that come up as you look at this text. Questions that skeptics bring up all the time when they look at Genesis chapter 3. Okay.
I want to say one thing on that, Hugh. There's a train of thought in the Orthodox Church that says that the ban of Adam and Eve eating from the tree of knowledge of good and evil was not a permanent ban. They believe that after a while, God would have taught them, like you said, about good and evil, and he then would have allowed them to eat from it because they would have been able to handle it, and that's why it was there.
Yeah, that's a major debate amongst Christians, and typically Protestant Christians argue that no, God never intended that they would eat of the tree because they interpret it as Adam and Eve personally experiencing the difference between good and evil, and that God's intent is they wouldn't have to go through that trauma, but they went ahead and did it anyway. And again, it kind of reminds me of having children, is that when you tell them, hey, you got my permission to do this, but you don't have my permission to do that, what do they typically do? They ignore the permission you give them, and they go against the things you say not to do. I don't think humanity has changed much over the millennia. Yes.
I have a question about one of the verses you cited at the beginning.
Can you get a little closer to the mic?
I have a question about one of the verses you cited at the beginning of your talk. It sounded like you were arguing that the seventh day of creation where God rested is still ongoing. And in John 5:17, I'm not sure which translation you used, but I looked at a few, and just naively taken alone, it sounds like Jesus is describing God, the Father, as still working, like in the current moment. So I'm curious how you understand that in light of your argument that the seventh day is still ongoing. And also, I imagine the Aramaic word translated as work there and the Hebrew word translated as work in Genesis may have subtly different meanings. So I'm curious if you could shed some light on what is meant by work in each of the two verses?
Those are great questions. And I was concerned about that the first time I was looking at Genesis. Well, what's going on here? What's going on in John chapter 5? But what gave me some illumination was reading through all the creation texts in the Bible cover to cover. I ignored everything else. I just said, I'm just going to pick out the stuff that deals with creation. And what I discovered is the multiple times it says that God began his works of redemption before he created anything at all. So right away it's making a distinction between God's redemptive work and his creation work. And kind of what I wrote in my book, Designed to the Core, everything that God creates is with the intent of redeeming humans from their sin and evil. That's the whole reason why God created us. So I look at galaxies. The galaxies and galaxy clusters were created with that in mind. And so what's happening in Genesis 1, for 6 days God creates, he doesn't do any redemption. During his creation work, there's no redemption going on. He creates for 6 days. On the seventh day, he stops creating, but now he takes up his work of redemption. And it tells us that God will create again, the new creation in Revelation 21 and 22. But he will not create. The eighth day will not begin until his work of redemption is finished. You know, Romans 8:23, the moment the full number of humans that God intends to redeem from their sin and evil have been redeemed, that's when the physics of the universe will be completed. God will remove this universe from existence, replace it with a brand new creation with different laws of physics and different dimensions. And that's going to be the eighth day of creation. He'll create again, but only after his work of redemption is finished. But that leaves open the question, how many weeks does God have on his calendar? We don't know, but he's told us, hey, my followers, my human followers, they will be ruling over the new creation with me. And so whatever God creates there, we're going to be managing it. Which I think is one reason why we see in Genesis 2, God is telling humanity, I've raised you up to manage the resources of planet Earth for your benefit and the benefit of life. And that actually has a present benefit, but it's also saying this is going to train you for your future career in the new creation, where you're going to have a much more challenging job of management than you got in this creation. So kind of look at it this way. In this creation, we're going through the undergraduate courses. In the new creation, there's going to be the graduate courses. And maybe get a postdoc after that, I don't know. So we don't know how many creation weeks God's got on his calendar. But yeah, that's the principle of the Sabbath. We work for 6 days, and then we stop our normal work, and then on the seventh day, we use that day to focus on the most important issues of life. Redemption is far more important than creation. But yeah, thanks for bringing that question up.
Thank you, Hugh. Frank McManus asks, Dr. Ross, what would happen on Earth if a God-like event stopped the rotation of our planet for 1 second?
It would not be pleasant. If God stopped the rotation of the planet for 1 second, we'd all be thrown off the surface of the planet into interplanetary space, where conditions would be quite unpleasant. Basically, your body would explode when that would happen. So you're not something that I would look forward to. But don't worry. What it tells us in Scripture is God's not going to do anything to the laws of physics until he completes his work of redemption. So don't worry about God stopping the rotation of the earth. For that to happen, you've got to disturb the laws of physics. The Bible repeatedly tells us that just like God is immutable, the laws of physics are immutable. And that explains why the scientific revolution flowed out of Christianity, not out of Confucianism, not out of Hinduism or Buddhism. Because Christianity alone made the point, the laws of physics are immutable. If they're immutable, it means we can trust our observations and experiments. And also unique to the Bible is this declaration of the scientific method. By the way, when I went to public school, I was taught the scientific method in grade 1, grade 2. We got it all 12 grades. None of my teachers told me where the scientific method came from. But at age 17, when I picked up a Bible, began to go through the creation text, I said, that's where the scientific method came from. And it's not just me saying that. There are theologians, especially the Scottish Academic Press, who's produced a 28-volume set documenting that the scientific method comes out of the biblical creation text and Reformation theology. So there's a reason why the scientific revolution flowed out of that time in human history when the Bible became available to the masses and not just to a select priesthood.
Hi. When you say that redemption, from what you said, it sounds like you were saying that that was a central part of creation.
Yes.
Maybe almost the preliminary requirement in creation. So when you say that, to me, that means that God created man with his expectation that they're going to sin. Otherwise, yes. If not so, you wouldn't need that redemption. And so if he created man with the expectation of sin, you have Adam and Eve in the garden, God tells them not to eat of the tree. Okay, that's immediately a test of their obedience. Now, on the other hand, you can look at this from the point of view that God was looking at this to create man for the purpose of love. That is his primary value. He wanted to create man to obtain all this expanded experience of love, and he could not obtain that experience unless he tested them, because they cannot really show love unless there's a real choice that they have to make. So the tree then becomes a real choice of whether they're going to obey God or not. Well, they failed the test, they didn't obey God, and therefore, and having failed God, okay, that was God's test to show whether they really loved him or not. And so that test has to exist. Otherwise, if there's no test, there's no way that man can show meaningful love to God. Okay, so anyway, I'm just building that backwards from this idea of that redemption was created as a preliminary standard. And so that's the first time I've heard that. Anyway, what do you think of all that?
Well, you're basically getting into what we're going to talk about when we get into Genesis chapter 3. Yeah. God's primary act is one of redemption. So he began his works of redemption before he created anything. All you're correct. When God created, it was the knowledge that sin and evil would come. And it tells us that God created to expand the expression of his love. In order for love to have any real depth and strength, that means he has to create beings with strong free will. So he created both angels and humans with strong free will. And with that strong free will does come the risk that many of those beings will say, you know, I really don't want to relate to you. And so God knew that by creating beings with strong free will, sin and evil were inevitable. But he created with that in mind. And so the laws of physics that we're subjected to are basically optimally designed to deal with sin and evil. And one thing you notice in Romans chapter 8, the moment that God's redemptive work is finished, so is the role of the laws of physics. And so we only need thermodynamics, gravity, electromagnetism, and the strong and weak nuclear force as long as God is in the process of redeeming angels and humans. And so the moment that's done, those laws of physics are replaced with new laws of physics. As Jesus said, in this world you'll have tribulation. In this world, you're going to have thermodynamics and gravity and electromagnetism. That immediately is going to bring tribulation into your life. But you only have to put up with it until God's work of redemption is finished. In the new creation, there's no thermodynamics. There's no gravity. There's no electromagnetism. Nor is there the weak and strong nuclear force. They're not needed anymore because sin and evil are no longer a possibility. So one of the questions we're going to ask is what did Adam and Eve lack in the garden before they sin, which every follower of Jesus Christ today possesses? So what we're going to learn is, hey, we're subject to these laws of physics. We're experiencing tribulation throughout our whole of our life, but we're actually in a better spot than Adam and Eve were before they ate of the fruit. So that's what's coming when we get into Genesis chapter 3. And we're also going to see, notice that God had a different option for humans than he did for the angels. When the angels rebelled, there was no pathway of redemption for them. When humans rebelled, there was a pathway. The pathway was physical death. So God immediately took away access to the tree of life. And the text is clear. Adam and Eve had permission to eat of the tree of life. They never partook of that. Again, the analogy of children, right? You say, you got my permission to do this? They ignore it, and they go after something you tell them not to do. Apparently, Adam and Eve never partook of that tree of life. But because they didn't, that opened an option for God to use the tool of physical death to deliver us from the far worse consequence of spiritual death. So we're in a different category than the angels. And for that reason, we're being prepared for a career in the new creation that the angels cannot fulfill. Right now, we're lower than the angels. A time will come when we'll be above the angels. And hey, we all complain about physical death. It's inevitable. But it's actually a gift that God brought upon us. Every time I say that, I get blasted on my social media. What do you mean death is good? But I'm willing to take that blast. It basically happens to me nearly every day. So I kind of get used to it.
Thank you, Hugh. James Vierdug asks, why did the serpent choose to trick Eve instead of Adam?
Why did the serpent choose to trick Eve instead of Adam? Hey, come next week, we're going to talk about Ezer. And basically, Ezer talks about how God designed the man and the woman to work together as a team. And what happened with Satan, he knew that they worked together as a team. He was going to have a problem. What did he do? He waited until Adam and Eve were apart from one another. Divide and conquer. Divide and deceive. Incidentally, Satan is using the same strategy today. He divides us. I get to officiate marriages quite frequently. When I officiate a marriage, I tell the man and the woman, God is bringing you together as a team. But watch out for Satan. He's going to try to divide you. And when he divides you, he's going to be able to single you out and attack you one by one. You need to remain united as God intended in marriage and realize that God puts you together in marriage to have a mission. That's why I titled this thing in Genesis 2, The Mission, God's Mission for Humanity. It doesn't work if men try to do it all by themselves. It doesn't work if women try to do it all by themselves. They need to be a team. Hey, come next week. It's going to be fun.
Thank you, Hugh. I think we have time for one more question. Sherwin Gibbons asked, can science give evidence that humans have souls?
Can science give evidence that humans have souls? Probably where science has really contributed to this is the research that's been done on prayer. This actually came up in the debate I had at Caltech with Victor Stenger, because he was arguing in his studies of the literature, prayer has no benefit. Therefore, this idea that we humans have a soul or a spirit is purely bogus. We're simply physical. When we die, we go to the dust. We're no better off than a piece of dust or a piece of rock. Those were his last words in the debate. I remember looking out at the audience of skeptics and atheists there saying, remember one thing, you're nothing but cold nothing. You have no meaning, no purpose, no value. You're no better off than a rock or a piece of dust. I talked to him afterwards and said, you know, you're the one honest atheist is here. There is nothing soulish and nothing spiritual. But I also shared with him, you know, these papers you were citing about how prayer has no value, it depends who's praying. I mean, the studies he was citing is where they just gather people from all different belief backgrounds, put them together, had them pray for people in hospitals, double-blind studies, and basically show we don't see any difference whether they're prayed for or not prayed for. But there's several papers in scientific literature that says if you gather together Bible-believing Christians who believe in the power of prayer and do a double-blind study, the people being prayed for dramatically benefit from the prayers. So that right away gives you some evidence. There's something going on beyond the physical when that happens. And so, again, it's who is praying that makes the difference. And you say, what's the bottom line of those studies? The people prayed for, number one, they don't know whether or not they're being prayed for. So it really is the people praying don't know who they're praying for. The people being prayed for don't know that they're being prayed for. But the ones being prayed for by people, Christians who believe in the power of prayer, they recover 48 hours faster from surgery and their infirmities than people who are not being prayed for. And what they also notice is their behavior is radically different. They're responding very kindly to the nurses and doctors. They're joyful in their spirit, and they're reaching out to help other patients compared to the ones that are not being prayed for. So that is in the scientific literature, and you'll actually find an article I wrote on our website that gives you citations to those papers. So that's one example of how a scientific study is actually showing us there's something going on beyond the physical, but there's many other studies that are being done. There's actually whole journals in the scientific literature devoted to that.
I would say too, Hugh, that all the evidence from near-death experiences gives us very powerful evidence that there's an immaterial soul that we have.
There's actually a whole journal on near-death experiences.
Right.
And we had reasons to believe. We now have a member of our scholar community, Michael Sabom. He's a cardiologist, and he intended to write a book debunking near-death experiences. And as he did his research, he did a 180 and became a believer. And he's written two books on it now, and he describes people that claim to be conscious while they had an out-of-body experience. But he says what really persuaded him, there was this one woman, Pamela, who was undergoing surgery and claimed to have an out-of-body experience. But she was able to describe in detail instruments that were beyond the view of the body that was on the gurney and describe in detail these instruments that would have been out of her view, but being out of the body, she could see them. So she described where she was able to see the instruments and describe them in detail. And so, you know, if that happens once, you might say, well, maybe it happened to know about that kind of instrument ahead of time and just guessed it. But when you have a couple of hundred examples like that, you realize, no, there really is something to these near-death encounters. I personally had a cousin that had a near-death experience. He fell in a snowfield in Canada and was considered to be dead for 5 minutes, but he was resuscitated and came back. But he shared with me what he experienced during those 5 minutes. And he said, I had these amazing, wonderful conversations with people ahead of me that were Christians who had died that I knew personally. And I said, what I experienced in those 5 minutes, I thought for sure I'd been dead for a whole day because those conversations were incredibly complex. He remembered them in detail. He shared them with me. And I said, John, what you experienced was leaving your body, but also leaving the constraint of being confined to a single dimension of time. And you were brought into geometric time where you could have all these amazing intimate conversations simultaneously. So yes, you were dead for 5 minutes, but what you experienced in our time frame was much longer than that. So yeah, I just gave you a couple of examples. There's all kinds of examples we can cite in the scientific literature showing there is something beyond the physical realm. And it tells us in Ecclesiastes 3:11, God has written eternity on the heart of every human being. This is something I noticed when I was participating in that weekend conference at Caltech, sponsored by the Skeptic Society. The five physicists that were speaking, claiming there was no God, also were claiming that they did have ultimate meaning and destiny in their life. They couldn't get around the fact that God had written on their heart, your life has value beyond these few decades here on earth. God has literally written eternity in the heart of every human being, which is why we're all compelled to think, what happens after I die? And does my life have value? So even these very committed atheists seem to have this sense, my life has meaning and purpose. The exception was Victor Stenger. He says, hey, if you really look at this logically and rationally, and there is no God, our lives have no value whatsoever. But it's hard to live with that.
Thank you so much. Would you please close us in prayer?
Yeah, my pleasure. Father in heaven, we thank you for this time that we can study these issues. Thank you for giving us a Sabbath where we can set aside our work and really dialogue and discuss with one another the really important issues of life. Lord, we all live here in America where people seem very much caught up in their work. Thank you that we live at a time in the history of humanity where technology and wealth is so great that we actually have really meaningful jobs, but may our jobs never get in the way of taking regular time aside to focus on the most important issues of life. And I pray to you would give us opportunities to encourage people we know to engage in us with these kind of dialogues. In Jesus' name, amen. Thank you.